April 16, 1912, the English Channel. Before dawn, a single-engine monoplane climbs out over the white cliffs of Dover in a pre-dawn sky, the color of pewter, heading south toward France. The pilot is bundled against the cold in a purple satin flying suit, a wool-lined leather hood pulled down over a helmet, goggles down below. The white cliffs are already dissolving into morning haze, ahead nothing but 22 miles of open water and low cloud, and the belief that France is somewhere out there on the other side. The engine is a gnome rotary, 50 horsepower. If you have never heard one run, it sounds unlike anything in a modern hangar. The whole engine spins with the propeller. There is a roar and a vibration that goes right through the airframe, through the seat, through your bones. The exhaust and the lubrication oil blow back into the open cockpit. The oil is castor oil. You breathe it and smell it for days afterward. The wind at 1,500 feet over the channel on an April morning is cold enough to make your eyes water even behind the goggles. That pilot is a 36-year-old journalist from New York named Harriet Quimby, and in 59 minutes she will land on a beach in France and become the first woman in history to fly across the English Channel. You have probably never heard of her, almost nobody has, and that is one of the great injustices in aviation history. I'm Tail Dragger, this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we're going back to 1912. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. To understand who Harriet Quimby was, you have to understand what aviation was in 1911. The Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk in December of 1903. By 1911, that is 8 years, long enough for the airplane to become real, not long enough for it to become safe. Most aviation at that point was exhibition flying, barnstorming. A pilot would show up at a county fair or an aerodrome, do loops and low passes over a crowd of several thousand people, collect a fee and move on to the next town. The aircraft were fragile. The engines were unreliable. Weather forecasting was essentially non-existent. There was no standard training program, no regulatory framework, no one keeping careful score of what was killing people and why. Men were dying in airplanes with some regularity. The papers covered the crashes with the same breathless excitement they covered the flights. It was that kind of era. Into this world, in the summer of 1911, walked Harriet Quimby. She was born in Michigan somewhere around 1875, though she was deliberately vague about her age, as many women of that era were. She had come west to San Francisco as a young woman, started writing for newspapers there, and eventually made her way to New York, where she became a drama critic and feature writer for Leslie's Illustrated Weekly. She was good at her job, sharp eye, clean prose, an instinct for the story inside the story. Somewhere around 1910, she went to watch an air meet. She stood on the wrong side of the fence and decided that needed to change. In the summer of 1911, she enrolled at the Moisant School of Aviation on Long Island, New York. John Moisant had been one of the most famous aviators of his day before he was killed in a crash in New Orleans at the end of 1910. His brother Alfred kept the school running on the family's reputation and on genuine competence. They trained on Moisant monoplanes, which were similar in design to the French Blériot type that was the most popular aircraft of the day. Quimby took her training seriously. She showed up before the other students to get more time in the airplane. She pushed the instructors to explain not just the procedure, but the reason behind the procedure. In those early days of aviation, a lot of what passed for instruction was folk wisdom and improvisation. A careful mind could do better than that, and she had a careful mind. She also kept her training quiet. She did not want the press writing about her as a student. She understood the difference between a student pilot story and a licensed pilot story. She was managing the narrative, as a good journalist would. On August 1st of August 1911, Harriet Quimby passed her licensing tests before the Aero Club of America. She became the first woman in the United States to hold a pilot's license, certificate number 37. The press noticed. She became something of a celebrity of a particular early aviation type. She became one of the faces of flying at a moment when flying needed good faces. She did exhibition flights, she flew in Mexico, she wrote about all of it for Leslie's, and throughout the winter of 1911 to 1912, she was working quietly on her next move. She was going to cross the English Channel. Now let me tell you about Louis Blériot, because you cannot understand what the Channel meant without him. In July of 1909, Blériot became the first person to cross the English Channel by air. 37 minutes in his monoplane. The English were rattled. The Channel had been their natural moat since the Norman invasion of 1066. The Spanish Armada had failed to cross it. Napoleon had studied it and thought better of it. And now a Frenchman in a fabric airplane had flown over it in less time than it takes to have a proper lunch. The military implications were enormous and sobering. The sporting implications were electric. The Channel crossing became the great benchmark of early aviation, and as the years passed, the question arose, who would be the first woman to cross? Quimby intended to answer that question. She arranged to borrow a Blériot 11 monoplane. This is worth describing because it helps you understand exactly what she was taking on. The Blériot 11 is a wood-framed, fabric-covered monoplane braced with wire. The wingspan is just under 27 feet. The fuselage is roughly 25 feet long. In the nose, a 50-horsepower Gnome rotary engine, maximum cruising speed around 50 to 60 miles per hour. There is no enclosed cockpit. You sit in a small curved seat in the open air, stick between your knees, rudder bar at your feet. Instruments, an altimeter of uncertain accuracy, a tachometer, and in Quimby's case, a compass strapped to her knee because the magnetic influence of the spinning engine made a panel-mounted compass unreliable. That is the sum total of what she had to navigate with over 22 miles of open water in April fog. She traveled to England in early April of 1912. She kept the plan as quiet as possible. A mechanic named Hasse, who had worked for Blériot himself, prepared the airplane. A well-regarded British pilot named Gustav Hamel was let into the secret to help with planning and preparation. Hamel was worried. He knew the channel. He knew what April mornings over the Strait of Dover looked like, and when he saw the conditions on the morning of April 16th, he offered Quimby a deal. He would dress in her flying suit, make the crossing himself, and she could take the credit publicly. Nobody would know, she declined. The story was the experience, not just the outcome. She was the one who had to be in the cockpit. She was at the airfield at Dover at 3 o'clock in the morning. They ran the engine, checked what could be checked. The fog was thick. Hamel recommended once more that she wait. There would be better days, he said. At 5:25, she throttled up the Gnome, rolled across the wet grass, and lifted off. She climbed to 1,500 feet, and the fog swallowed her. No horizon, no visual reference to the water below, no radio, no weather data. The compass on her knee was giving her a southerly heading, and the gyroscopic torque of the spinning Gnome was trying to twist the airplane, as rotary engines do, and the cold was working through her suit and the castor oil was in her eyes. Here is what she did not have. She did not have an artificial horizon. She did not have a turn coordinator. She did not have anything that would tell her whether the wings were level or whether she was banking into a graveyard spiral she couldn't see. Jimmy Doolittle would not demonstrate that blind flight was survivable with proper instruments until 1929. What Quimby had was feel. The pressure in the seat, the load in the stick, the angle of the airstream against her face. She flew by those signals alone. She came down lower, looking for the surface of the channel to give her some visual reference. She found it. Barely. She kept the compass pointing south. She held altitude by feel and by nerve. She flew that airplane for 59 minutes through conditions that would make most of us very uncomfortable in a modern airplane, with a full glass panel and an autopilot watching over our shoulder. When France appeared below her, she was not at Calais. The fog and a wind she hadn't fully accounted for had pushed her west along the coast. She was over a beach near a village called Hardelot, roughly 25 miles from her intended landing field near the Blériot factory at Calais. She put the airplane down on the beach. A local fisherman and his young daughter came running out across the sand to see what had landed. They had no idea who this purple-clad figure climbing out of the monoplane was. They did not know what she had just done. She tried her limited French. They had no English. Eventually things sorted themselves out. She had crossed the English Channel. She returned to England, filed her account with Leslie's, did the interview she could, and went back about her business. She was pleased but not dramatic about it. She treated it the way a serious aviator should treat a successful flight, as confirmation that the preparation had been correct. Now, here's where history goes sideways. The night before Harriet Quimby crossed the English Channel, the ocean liner Titanic sank in the North Atlantic. The largest ship in the world on her maiden voyage struck an iceberg at 11:40, the night of April 14th, and was gone by 2:20 the morning of April 15th. 1,517 people died in the water. The news was still breaking when Quimby landed in France. By the time she got back to England, the press was at Southampton waiting for the rescue ship, Carpathia, which was bringing in survivors. Every telegraph wire in the world was running the Titanic story continuously. Harriet Quimby, the first woman to fly across the English Channel, received a few paragraphs in the papers, inside the paper on the third or fourth page. The aviation press covered her properly. Leslie's gave her a full account in her own words. But the general public was reading about the Titanic and would be reading about the Titanic for weeks. She kept working. She had exhibitions booked and she honored them. By the summer of 1912, she was one of the most well-known female pilots in America, though not nearly as famous as that Channel crossing deserved to have made her. She was scheduled to appear at the Harvard-Boston Aero Meet at Squantum, Massachusetts, in early July. She had a newer airplane by then, a 70-horsepower Blériot, faster and theoretically more capable. On the 1st of July 1912, she flew at Squantum with a passenger, a man named William Willard, whose father was managing the meet. Several thousand people watched from the shoreline. She flew out over Dorchester Bay, made her turns, headed back toward the aerodrome. The airplane pitched violently forward. Both Quimby and Willard were thrown from the cockpit. They fell several hundred feet into the water and the mud flat below. The airplane, relieved of their weight, recovered by itself and settled to a relatively gentle landing in the shallows, as if nothing had happened. Harriet Quimby was 37 years old. Nobody ever conclusively established what caused it. The Blériot had no seat harnesses. In 1912, nobody used seat harnesses. You simply sat in the cockpit and hoped, some investigators believed Willard, a non-pilot, grabbed for something in a moment of panic and upset the center of gravity catastrophically. Some believed a gust caught the tail at exactly the wrong moment. Some believed a control issue of some kind. The investigation, by the standards of the day, was inconclusive. What we know is that she was gone 11 months after she earned her license. The newspapers that had given her three paragraphs for the Channel crossing gave her more column inches in depth, which is how these things often went. I think about Harriet Quimby sometimes when I'm doing a pre-flight, and I look at the glass panel, and the autopilot, and the attitude indicator, and all the redundancy we take for granted now. All that technology we barely think about because it has just always been there in the cockpit we learned in. She crossed 22 miles of open water in fog with a compass on her knee. She did it because she decided it was worth doing, and because nobody told her she couldn't in a way she was willing to accept. She got two paragraphs because a ship sank the night before. She died 11 months later when the airplane she was flying had no way to keep her in it. There is something worth sitting with in that, back when AVHS was cheap and airspace was free. The pilots who had been around the longest were usually the ones who said the fewest words about their own accomplishments. They had a specific reverence for pilots who had done real things in real machines under genuinely hard conditions. Harriet Quimby belongs in that company, without qualification. If you are at a fly-in this season, ask somebody who crossed the English Channel first as a woman. See what you get. The primary sources here are Quimby's own writing in Leslie's Illustrated Weekly, the records of the Aero Club of America, and the historical research of Richard Hallion and Jacinta Bradley Kuntz. Good reading, all of it. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Clear skies.